This Is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. 1,000 families in Connecticut experience homelessness each year. Children in those families could be a child in your son or daughter's class. How should educators talk with students about homelessness? Coming up, we'll hear from the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. The nonprofit has created lesson plans for teachers to help them talk about it with students. The Coalition's Madeline Ravitch will join us later this hour. First, a proposal to merge CVS and Aetna, or for CVS to acquire Aetna in a $69 billion deal, faces its first hurdle after a public hearing. The state insurance department now has 30 days to decide whether to approve the deal, and the federal government must also give its approval. But is this a good deal for consumers? Do you think the merger will hinder competition and limit your savings? Or will a CVS-Aetna partnership lead to innovative, less expensive strategies to deliver health care? We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can email us, wherewelive@wmpr.org. As always, find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. I want to welcome back to the show Harriet Jones. She's business reporter for Connecticut Public Radio. Harriet, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome, Lucy.
Aetna has deep roots in the state of Connecticut. I read, I think a Governor Malloy quote is they've been here since 1853.
That's right. They were founded in Hartford in 1853 and, you know, pretty much synonymous with the insurance industry here, you know, really a very iconic corporate citizen of Hartford. But, you know, of late, that has been somewhat in doubt. We saw them try to do another huge merger a couple of years ago with Humana. As part of this kind of wave of consolidation in the healthcare industry, that got blocked by the Department of Justice, by federal antitrust regulators. And after that, there was some uncertainty. They actually, as part of the Humana merger, had, you know, kind of hinted they might move their headquarters out of Hartford. After that failed, the CEO, Mark Bertolini, announced plans that he was going to move the headquarters to New York City. They were going to build themselves a fancy new office block just, you know, right next to Chelsea Market in Lower Manhattan, you know, next to Google and YouTube and all the rest of it. But those plans again changed once the CVS deal came on the scene.
Remind us, Mark Bertolini's love for Hartford has waned over the last few years. So explain again why he wanted to move the headquarters to New York City.
So he's, you know, what he said is he wants to kind of reimagine the company, not as a legacy insurance company, but more to do with healthcare more broadly and to do with the data analytics of healthcare too. So he wanted to think of it more, you know, to have the technology component of the company be more prominent. And so he felt that Manhattan was, you know, a better place to do that. And I think he's also personally more fond of Manhattan than Hartford.
And so with the news that CVS was interested in acquiring Aetna, those concerns from Hartford officials like the mayor and others, the governor, that they would move the headquarters, that went away because CVS said that they didn't have any intention of wanting to see the headquarters out of state. But in terms of this potential deal. Coming up, we're going to hear about some of the concerns from consumer advocates and others. But what exactly needs to happen step by step in terms of approval for the CVS and Aetna acquisition?
So any big public company merger, you know, requires antitrust regulators to sign off on it. But if you're in a very heavily regulated industry like the insurance industry, like healthcare, there's that many more steps because not only does the DOJ itself at the federal level have to sign off, every state where you sell plans or you have operations also has to have its own hearing. The insurance department in that state might want to impose its own conditions. None of the states actually have, you know, they can't stop the deal, but they can recommend to the DOJ that, you know, in fact, California has in this case, you know, raised its very loud voice to the Department of Justice and said that it doesn't believe that this merger should go ahead. Whereas we've seen states like Connecticut, well, Connecticut hasn't ruled yet, but it also has imposed conditions on the company. It now has an agreement with CVS that it will keep Aetna's headquarters in Hartford for 10 years. It will keep its workforce at approximately the level it is now, which is about 5,300. It's going to keep that workforce level for 4 years. So regulators have those kinds of powers to impose conditions.
So that almost sweetens the deal for the state of Connecticut to try, if you guys want to get this this merger, this deal in place, what's in it for us? But there have been opinions out there that why just 10 years? Why not commit to Connecticut in the long term?
Right. Right. Yeah, of course. And I think you're right. There was an editorial in the Hartford Current saying, you know, why can't we just keep it here forever? You're never going to get that kind of commitment from a company because they have no idea, you know, what business conditions are going to be in the future, what the shape of the company is going to be in the future. So, you know, that's not realistic to expect to get in this type of negotiation.
In studio with me is Harriet Jones, business reporter for Connecticut Public Radio. As we talk about this pending deal with CVS looking to acquire Aetna, which is the third largest insurer in the nation. Coming up, we're going to learn more about CVS as a pharmacy benefit manager and some of the concerns with this idea of a PBM, as they're known, acquiring an insurance company. But in terms of when we look at the status quo and keeping Aetna here, in the state. This deal, is it likely to get approval from the federal government? Because I believe there was a previous deal between Cigna and Express Scripts, which is a similar kind of relationship that got approval.
Yeah, so these deals they're fairly new. So this is a deal essentially between a health insurer and what's called a PBM, a pharmacy benefits manager, which is the bit of CVS that's kind of interesting in this deal. One of those exists already. That's Optum and United Healthcare. Another one just did get its federal approval. It's not. This is Cigna and Express Scripts. Cigna, of course, a Bloomfield-based insurer. It has its DOJ approval. It doesn't have all of its state sign-offs yet. So it's not quite over the finish line, but it's very, very close. It's going to get there. So the tea leaves are kind of good for this deal. It's slightly less straightforward than Cigna Express Scripts because they do have some overlap in their Medicare D and Medicare Part D provision, Aetna and CVS do. So I think we will see the DOJ requiring some divestitures. They'll have to sell off parts of the company. But I think at this stage, you know, industry watchers would be surprised if the DOJ blocked this.
Another development for Aetna and CVS to see this deal go through. Aetna agreed to sell off their Medicare Part D. Mm-hmm. So this covers a prescription plan that covers 2 million people because CVS also has a huge share of that Medicare program. And so, again, this would maybe alleviate some concerns from federal regulators about antitrust.
That's what they're trying to do. Because I think that people would have thought that they would have had much too large of a slice of the market. They would have dominated the market far too much had they not been asked to sell off, or, you know, had they not volunteered to sell off that part of their business. So that, yeah, it's a signal to regulators that, yes, we're willing to work with you and, you know, we're willing to address your anti-competitive concerns.
Can we talk about the larger trends that we're seeing here? Because you'd mentioned Aetna and other companies were trying to merge with insurance companies previously. That was rejected by the federal government. But in terms of when we think about our healthcare system and the rising costs of prescription drugs, we just recently talked about how hospitals are working to acquire more physician practices. This move to consolidate and have partnerships, is it really a good deal for patients like you and I if we need health care down the road?
I think, you know, that's the huge question, right? I think we heard two economists give evidence before the Connecticut Insurance Department just in the last few days who said they really don't know. They couldn't tell us, you know, it's going to have this effect or it's going to have that effect. It's going to raise prices or it's going to lower prices. They don't know. And I think this is the problem with a lot of what's going on in healthcare right now. You know, we saw the Affordable Care Act, you know, try to kind of grapple with this monster, although many people, you know, there's a big criticism of the Affordable Care Act that it didn't really address the cost curve. It didn't look to bring down costs. None of the Republican plans that have been brought up, you know, once the Republicans took control of the White House and of Congress, none of their plans have really addressed cost either. So in some senses, I think what's happening here is that we're seeing the marketplace itself try to grapple with this question of how do we organize healthcare in this country and how do we address that, you know, kind of rising cost curve.
Earlier, we talked about this commitment from CVS and Aetna that if the deal goes through, they're going to stick with Connecticut for another 10 years. That's also probably good for the narrative that policymakers are constantly combating, which is this idea that you have big companies wanting to leave the state. And I'm curious, as a business reporter, do we have companies of this stature interested in coming to Connecticut?
It's a complicated picture. You know, I think we We tend to see the headlines, you know, GE leaves, Aetna wants to leave, and we think, you know, there's a mass flight out of Connecticut. The picture is a lot more complicated than that. You know, and those big names tend to capture the headlines. But if you think about other big companies, Stanley is committed to being here. UTC is committed to being here. We've seen, I think the state would point to things like Infosys coming into Hartford, Seven Stars Cloud, which is now called something else. It's called Ideanomics, the big Chinese company that's coming to West Hartford. But, you know, even below that kind of big corporate level, there's a whole ecosystem of companies that we really have to think about. We have to think about how are we nurturing startups? How are we persuading people to start businesses here? And what are we doing for our growth companies, those kind of in the middle who maybe, you know, they maybe have 100 employees or so. They're not a huge company, but they're starting to grow. They're starting to, you know, get their operations established here. The business cycle and the business ecosystem is very complicated. And I think if you just judge by the headlines, you're not getting full picture.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Harriet Jones is here, business reporter for Connecticut Public Radio. And we want to hear from you, too. Are you insured by Aetna? Do you shop at CVS? What advantages or disadvantages do you see in this proposed merger between both companies? And why are pharmacists, doctors, and others speaking out against such a plan? WNPR's Harriet Jones is going to stay with us as we explore those questions. And coming up, we're going to hear from Connecticut's healthcare advocate, too. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. The American system of delivering health care has long been seen as broken. Efforts to dismantle the Federal Affordable Care Act have been helped as insurers leave state health exchanges. Now these insurance companies are looking for growth, and one way is through mergers and acquisitions. But is that the best kind of deal for consumers? Those questions have been raised in Connecticut as pharmacy giant CVS attempts to acquire Hartford-based Aetna, the third biggest insurer in the nation. For more on this proposal, in studio with me is Harriet Jones, business reporter for Connecticut Public Radio. And joining us now is Ted Doolittle, healthcare advocate for the state of Connecticut. Ted, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me, Lucy.
I understand there was a public hearing recently looking at this CVS wanting to acquire Aetna. Explain the concern before we get to what we heard at that hearing. When we think about types of mergers, there's horizontal mergers, and then what we're hearing now is a vertical integration, which is what would explain this particular deal between CVS and Aetna. Can you describe the difference in between both?
So you're absolutely right. The merger of two insurance companies is one thing. This is essentially, as you described, a pharmacy benefit middleman buying an insurance company. So it's two different types of businesses. That makes it somewhat easier to acquire perhaps some of the regulatory approvals needed, but the impact on consumers is still very important.
I mentioned pharmacy benefit managers. When we think about that as the middleman, explain how CVS, how they do business, and what are some of the concerns with how PBMs operate in terms of where savings technically go, not necessarily back to the consumer per se.
So my office represents consumers, and we represent folks who are having difficulties with their health insurance company. We have a staff of nurses and attorneys and paralegals who can represent people for free when they're trying to get a claim paid, something like that. So I come at it from the perspective of the consumer. And what we have here is a situation where the merger that is contemplated will have direct impacts on the amount of people, the amount that people have to pay when they are standing at the checkout counter at the pharmacy. So it sounds like a boring business story, but it gets a lot less boring when you're at CVS and somebody tells you the drug for your daughter is going to cost $500 that month.
When we think about this acquisition between CVS and Aetna, when we look at previous deals that the federal government has approved, we mentioned Express Scripts and what was the other?
Cigna.
Cigna.
Mm-hmm.
So have we seen the concerns that you and others have raised about this potential deal? Is that coming to play with the Cigna Express Scripts proposal? And what are we seeing from that plan?
So there are deals on the table that haven't been concluded, but the one that has been in place for a long time, of course, is the United Health Group. Optum is the name of their pharmacy middleman. I would say that the folks who are customers of United Health Group haven't, when they're talking to their neighbors over the fence, and you're an Aetna person versus a United Healthcare person, you're not paying less for drugs. So I would say that the savings really need to be carefully documented through this hearing process, and the state regulators, in this case the insurance department, should actually create some accountability and some they should try to understand what the savings are going to be, and they should hold the companies to account in later years. I would like to see, for instance, a 3-year, a 5-year, a 10-year check-in to see if the supposed savings have occurred. And if not, there should be some type of accountability and some true-up back to the consumers who are going to bear what I fear might be the higher costs of this merger.
Harriet, we mentioned the state insurance department has 30 days to consider whether to approve this deal. We heard Ted Doolittle suggest ways that the state could hold CVS and Aetna accountable. Is that something that the insurance company can then put in place? Say, well, if we're going to approve this, let's see where the cost savings actually go, and we want you to define it clearly for people so that they can so it's more transparent. Is that possible?
So certainly, you know, the newly merged company, if this goes through, is going to have a very long and intimate relationship with the Connecticut Insurance Department because they will be their regulator. So, you know, they're going to have ongoing negotiations and ongoing meetings and ongoing approvals that have to happen. So, yes, the Connecticut Insurance Department does have some leverage here. If it chooses to use it to say, you know, we'll put these conditions in place down the line, as Ted was describing, you know, we can audit you for, you know, how this is actually working for consumers. And if you don't meet these targets, you know, well, it will be interesting to see what teeth they can put in place. But yes, certainly they do have some options. And I think a lot of the consumer advocates like Ted have said this is what the insurance department should be doing. It can't block this merger in and of itself. It doesn't, you can't, you know, stop it going ahead, but it can certainly impose more conditions on it.
We reached out to CVS and Aetna if they wanted to come on the show, and they each provided a statement. Aetna President Karen Lynch shared, and this is something that they also shared at that public hearing before the legislature, the committee, "We have an incredibly fragmented, siloed system," she says. "It's too expensive and much too complicated to navigate through. Today's healthcare systems are largely designed to fix people when they're broken and not keep them healthy and active throughout their lives." So I wanted to go back to you, Ted Doolittle, again, Office of Healthcare Advocate. When we look at a potential deal like this, what are some of the benefits if you were to get that transparency, if you were able to see cost savings for consumers, if they can go to their local CVS and get preventative care and it's more accessible to them? Can you walk us through what some of the benefits of this proposal could be?
So, absolutely. And going back to Harriet's point about the conditions, I would like to see, I just somewhat assailed United Health Group. I want to give a shout out to them in terms of their recent pledge to start sending the rebates to the consumers for part of their business. I think United Health Group should extend that to all of their business. And I think there's an opportunity for Connecticut or other states who are considering this deal to ask Aetna CVS to make that kind of pledge. Are you going to make sure that the rebates that are big, that come from the pharmaceutical manufacturers, go to the actual person who's buying the drug as opposed to the health insurance company? Another thing we can do in terms of trying to create good corporate citizenship is Aetna is not on the exchange. United Healthcare is not on the exchange. Cigna is not on the exchange. Harvard Pilgrim's not on the exchange. There is more to good corporate citizenship than just sponsoring Little League ball teams. These folks should be on board with the exchange. Healthcare is different. Many people have won Nobel Prizes in economics explaining why healthcare is different. We can't make rational choices when it's our own health or the health of a loved one in place. Our community, for better or for worse, has gone down the road of the Affordable Care Act, and these companies are not participating, and I really think that that is doesn't reflect well on those companies.
Harry, can you remind us why these companies pulled out of the state health care exchange to begin with? Was it because they were losing money?
Basically, yes. They said it was far too expensive for them to be in. And the kinds of lives that they were covering, they were finding that the people they got through the exchange were older or sicker, had more issues. So it just wasn't a profitable business for them.
You can join our conversation as we talk about this potential deal between pharmacy giant CVS. Many of us shop there, as well as Aetna. You might get insurance through them, Hartford-based insurer, one of the third largest in the nation. Harriet Jones is here with us, business reporter for Connecticut Public Radio, and Ted Doolittle, healthcare advocate for the state of Connecticut. The number to call, 860-275-7266. Is this potential deal something that you're looking forward to? What are some of the weaknesses in the healthcare that you're receiving? Is it hard to get an appointment at your primary care physician? Would it be easier for you to go to the local Minute Clinic in your neighborhood? Again, the number 860-275-7266. I wanted to go back to you, Ted. We were talking about these vertically integrated systems, and I'd asked about, what are some potential benefits if the deal is done correctly? Kaiser Permanente, I guess, is an example of vertical integration. Could you describe that system out in California?
Yeah, so Kaiser Permanente is a system that originated as a physicians group many years ago, maybe 80 years ago or so. And what they did was they gradually just took on the patients without the interference of an insurance company. So Kaiser Permanente is a model where there's no difference between the insurance company and the provider. In other words, if you're a Kaiser Permanente insured, you go to a Kaiser Permanente doctor, and they have thousands and thousands of doctors and hospitals and so forth. That can create great efficiencies, and Kaiser Permanente is just one example. There are several organically grown, pretty old systems: Geisinger in Pennsylvania, Intermountain Health in the Rocky Mountain area, that have this kind of integration. So there's no separate insurance company. That can be very efficient. Here we're talking about something that hasn't grown up organically. It's a merger. It's an acquisition. And as I mentioned before, with the United Health Group Optum model that we're looking at here, I don't see that there has been a great amount of efficiency or savings. I could be convinced otherwise, but I haven't seen the evidence of it. So that's what gives me the concern about these proposed mergers, the Aetna tie-up that we're talking about now, and then also the Cigna Express Scripts merger.
We mentioned the public hearing earlier. I think one of the people that spoke was Nate Tinker from the Connecticut Pharmacy Association. There's actually independent pharmacies out there.
Yeah, there are. Yeah.
How will this kind of deal hurt them, Harriet?
Yeah, they were very concerned that it may do, because, of course, CVS is a behemoth in the pharmacy industry. And, they're concerned that if CVS now controls this big network, they're going to say, well, you independent pharmacy, you have to take our deal or you can't be part of our network, take it or leave it. And he's concerned that independent pharmacies will be driven out of business by this.
In terms of the underserved community, Ted Doolittle, again, Office of the Healthcare Advocate, these CVS Minute Clinics, are they something that could be seen in more of these underserved communities?
Look, I think any time we have more clinics, especially in underserved areas, it can be a good thing. I think you have to look at how it's done. Is Aetna going to now require all its folks to go to the CVS Minute Clinic and reduce their choice and perhaps take away business from other competitors and take away choice from the consumers? Those are some of the issues that we need to really scrutinize.
When we think about the factors in play that are causing these insurance companies and pharmacy benefit managers to think about partnering, how much does Amazon have to do with their concern about being disrupted, Harriet? Because Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, they're all joining together to think about what are more cost-effective ways to deliver healthcare to their employees.
Yeah, certainly the prospect of Amazon getting into the pharmacy business or into the healthcare business in a big way. It's certainly a kind of a specter for these companies. They have to think about what kind of competition that would provide to them. But it also, Amazon to a certain extent provides a model too of a company that, has grown from one specialty into many, many specialties. That's in the back of their minds for sure.
And Ted Doolittle, before we run out of time, we know that the Affordable Care Act and efforts to dismantle it are still in play in Washington, I believe, in the courts. But when we look at a deal like this, is it a signal to the federal government about new ways to deliver health care and the push towards single payer down the road?
Well, it certainly is a new way to do business. And when you're talking about single payer, actually, you have to think whether you're for or against single payer. You might want to ask who's going to be the single payer. Aetna would probably be fine with single payer if Aetna were the single payer, right? And so, as they try to expand their empires, that's exactly what they're trying to do. Whether or not you want a profit-driven company to be at the center of an expansion like that, or you want a nonprofit-driven organization like the Medicare and the Medicaid agencies down in D.C., or the healthcare exchange up in Connecticut to be at the center. Those are some of the key issues to really look at. Who are going to be the decision makers, and who are going to have the best interests of the consumers at heart better? Is it going to be profit-driven entities, or is it going to be quasi-public, let's call it, entities like the Access Health Connecticut Obamacare Exchange, the ACA Exchange up in Connecticut?
We'll have to leave it there. I want to thank Ted Doolittle, healthcare advocate for the state of Connecticut, for joining us. Thank you, Ted.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
Also, Harriet Jones was here, business reporter for Connecticut Public Radio. Always a pleasure, Harriet.
Thanks, Lucy.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we're going to look at an innovative way to talk about homelessness in the classroom. But first, Where We Live focuses on many topics and issues each day, from healthcare to the upcoming elections to exploring initiatives and programs found in our communities. We don't just talk to policymakers and experts. We talk to real people throughout our state who have stories to tell. If you appreciate these conversations, support us and Connecticut Get Public Radio with a pledge. Here are two of my colleagues with the number to call. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up Thursday, humans have a long history as hunters of the land and water. On the next Where We Live, we'll consider the factors that have motivated men and women to hunt over the centuries and examine the environmental effects of hunting today. Do you hunt? We want to hear from you. That conversation on Thursday. Now, 1,000 families in Connecticut experience homelessness each year, and that includes more than 2,000 children. How should educators talk with students in the classroom about homelessness? The Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness has created lesson plans for teachers to help them talk with students about it. For more about this initiative, joining me now in studio is Madeline Ravitch, Development Advisor and Director of the Be Homeful Project at the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Madeline, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
When we talk about homelessness, we might think of an adult face, but this does impact children. How big of a problem is it in the state?
Well, as you said, there are 1,000 families, including over 2,000 children, who become homeless in our state each year. And when we say that, those are specifically the numbers of families that enter the shelter system. And so a few years ago, we started this campaign called the Be Homeful Project to address this issue, because what we had found that it was that in most cases, it was possible to prevent families from becoming homeless in the first place if we just intercepted them at the front door of shelter and found ways to keep them housed in the first place. So it's a big problem, but it's a solvable problem. And that's what we want people to know, that it's possible to end homelessness when we really focus on the specific strategy.
When we think about housing insecurity and the impact on children, what are the lasting effects?
Well, so it's an interesting fact that the number one predictor of whether somebody will be homeless as an adult is if they experience homelessness as a child. So it's really, the trauma runs deep and it has lifelong impacts. And so that's why we really are trying to cut off this vicious cycle before it starts. But there are health impacts, both mental and physical. There are lots of different effects that homelessness has on children throughout life.
You mentioned the Be Homeful Project, and we were really interested in this curriculum that's been developed. Tell us about the idea, and how do you talk about this issue, whether it's K through second grade up until high school?
Right. So as I said, one of the interesting things we've learned is that people's minds, when they are thinking about addressing homelessness, goes towards a lot of the stereotypes they have about homelessness. They imagine a person on the street. They may not think that there are children in their communities who are experiencing homelessness right now. And so that's why we started this campaign to really address that issue. And we realized that while for adults, many of these ideas are baked into us, for children, we actually have an opportunity to shape minds and get kids to think differently and to not think about children experiencing homelessness as those other people, but to realize that these are our peers and that we're all in this together. So we with this in mind, we developed lesson plans. Backing up a little bit, a few years ago, joined forces with the iconic Paddington Bear, who's a storybook character who was homeless at the beginning of his story. And so we said, this is a great character. Let's make him our spokes bear, and let's figure out ways to use his story to engage kids in age-appropriate ways. And so originally we had these story time guides that libraries throughout the state used, and that was a really wonderful thing to watch libraries all around the state doing these Paddington story times. And then we started to learn through that process that kids of different ages absorbed this information differently, and that we started to learn how we could speak differently to children at different ages. So we developed lesson plans that can be used starting as young as pre-K. At the pre-K level, there are four different versions. The pre-K level, they focus on the importance of having a home and what having a home means to me. At the elementary school level, we focus on using Paddington's experience to think about how homelessness, how it would feel to be in his shoes. In middle school and high school, we use a fabulous video of actually one of my colleagues and her sister talking about their own experience growing up with homelessness and how it's affected the trajectory of our lives, of their lives. And it all rolls up to kids doing marmalade drives in honor of Paddington's favorite food, which are coin drives. And so right now, actually, now until Thanksgiving, we are not only trying to encourage schools to use these lesson plans, but also to hold marmalade drives with money they're raising being used to help families stay housed in the first place. And I should also mention there's another lesson plan that goes hand in hand with the high school plan that is focused on homeless and unaccompanied youth. And that's a really powerful lesson plan that we're hoping that students and schools will use during Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week, which is November 10th through 18th. Those lesson plans are really amazing because they educate students about their own rights under McKinney-Vento, which is the federal law for unstably housed youth, and gives kids the ability to learn how they can help themselves, how to help others. And really, you know, our message is we're all in this together, and we're giving kids the tools to act on that.
Madeline Ravitch is Development Advisor and Director of the Be Homeful Project of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. As we learn about this initiative, this curriculum available to educators across the state to talk with students about homelessness, you mentioned in the high school level there's this specific lesson plan mentioning unaccompanied minors. Tell us what went into that, because so often in the news we're hearing about what migrant families are enduring, but chances are, you know, when we hear about certain states taking in unaccompanied minors, we know that's a reality here in Connecticut. I mean, how do you talk about this current event issue in the classroom with these students?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. These lesson plans are really designed to focus on homelessness, and we haven't really stretched into the larger territories. We have in certain ways insofar as we've had a fund that we worked with United Way and many foundations across the state on to address Puerto Rico and that crisis, because all these things are intertwined. But for you know, students at the high school level, what people don't realize is that homelessness exists at the, you know, and that it's a problem that we've worked over the last three years to unearth through the Homeless Youth Count, which takes place in January. It's an all-volunteer effort where volunteers across the state work together to do a count of homeless youth, and that's something that kids can be involved in. But you know, I think that again, we've figured out that and working with schools, actually, it was the schools in Meriden that we worked with to start the high school youth lesson plans, that when kids are equipped to help their peers, we can figure out who's experiencing homelessness right now and connect them with resources to help.
And we should mention to our listeners, if they are experiencing issues of finding housing or homelessness, they can always call 211. And we've been talking about the student perspective, and so I wanted to bring into the conversation Grace Furia, who's a ninth grade student at Hall High School in West Hartford. Grace, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Madeline, if you could tell us how Grace got involved in the project, and then Grace, tell us about your perspective as a student talking about homelessness in the classroom.
Well, I'm so thrilled that Grace is here in the studio with us today. Grace is one of our Paddington ambassadors, which is what we call kids who step up and learn about homelessness and take the lead on educating their peers and holding drives to help their peers. And Grace has been working with us for a few years. I first met her when she was in sixth grade, working on a homelessness project, and she's stuck with it, and you know, really has influenced others. And we're so excited to have her here talking about the project.
So, Grace, in sixth grade, you were working on a homelessness project. Tell us about that, and then how you've been able to keep participating with the coalition.
Yeah, so my mom works in the homeless housing world, and we both thought it'd be a very interesting project to do. And actually, she reached out to Madeline and asked for an interview. And so she interviewed me, and I interviewed her, and I learned more about homelessness, and I got really interested in it and wanted to help out more.
Well, we were talking earlier about the stereotypes of homelessness. So as a student in the public school system, what are some stereotypes or ideas that your fellow students have about homelessness? And how is something like this helping to combat that?
Definitely. So I really love these lessons plans because it shows that students that homelessness isn't just adults, it impacts children too, and we can be part of the solution.
And Madeline, if a teacher is talking about homelessness in the classroom and one of the students in the classroom is someone that's experienced homelessness, how do they navigate that?
Right. So when it's possible to have a social worker in the room for a conversation, I think that's a really great thing. But we really tried to design these lesson plans in a way that is sensitive to the dynamics that could play out in the classroom. Ultimately, what people should know is that every school has a McKinney-Vento liaison, which is the person charged with making sure that all of the rights of children experiencing homelessness are taken care of. And so the teacher should connect the student with the McKinney-Vento liaison if they aren't already to make sure that they're getting whatever help they can get.
When we think about the lesson plans that you've created and talking about this in a respectful way, how do these lesson plans encourage empathy?
So empathy is a big theme right now, and so you know. But we've always thought empathy is important, and I think that we live in a state of haves and have-nots, and it's very easy for people to think of homelessness as an issue that doesn't affect them. When in fact, what we find from our data is that homeless families come from many, if not all, of the towns in the state.
Again, we're talking about homelessness and ways to encourage a conversation about the issue that impacts many of our community members, no matter where we live, but also ways to help. And I think that's part of your approach, too, with the Be Homeful Project, Madeline.
Right. And I think building empathy, as you said, is so important that when we can help kids think about how homelessness affects their peers and learn that they can work together and that there is a solution that, by the way, only costs $1,000 per family to prevent families from being housed. People not only are able to sort of channel that compassion, they're able to understand that there's actually a solution that works.
We've been talking about homelessness, and it's already October, and often this issue, there's a lot of attention around the holidays, but this is a year-round problem for some in our community.
Well, not only is it year-round, one of the things that's interesting, as you said, people think about homelessness during the holidays, but in fact, family homelessness peaks during the summertime, and the reason for that is that when children let out of school, adds an extra burden for families that are already working so hard. So you know, we do see spikes in homelessness during the summertime. But we also know that this is when people think about homelessness, which is why we actually are in the midst of our Be Homeful for the Holidays campaign. We just kicked off this week. This is an annual campaign we do with Connecticut Realtors and Citizen Bank and United Way, where for every $25 donated to our emergency fund, a Paddington Bear book blankie or board book is given to a child in shelter. So we've done this for the last 2 years. It's a way for people to be able to give something tangible, which is what we know adults like to do during the holidays, for children. Adults can hold these drives to give gifts to children in shelters, but the best part is that every year this raises over $50,000 for us that we're able to use to keep families housed, and that's 50 families. So, you know, that's a pretty big deal.
Listeners can learn more about this project at BeHomeful.org. And before we go, Madeline, we hear so often about how Connecticut has really made strides in ending homelessness in the communities. I think the goal is by 2020. And I'm curious if you could talk about some of the how the numbers have decreased.
It's actually been remarkable. Connecticut's a real leader in the country, and other parts of the country look to us to learn what we're doing, especially around chronic homelessness, which is an issue that we've been working on for quite a while, and around family and youth homelessness. But we've seen a 25% decline in homelessness since 2007, which is really dramatic. And so we're seeing that when we use data and when we develop by-name lists of who's experiencing homelessness and help build the system around 211, we really can make a difference. And that's why this campaign is so important, because when the resources are there, we can help more people stay in their homes and make sure that no child has to experience the hardship of homelessness.
Well, I want to thank Madeline Ravitch, again, Development Advisor and Director of the Be Homeful Project at the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Also, thanks to Grace Furia, a ninth grade student at Hall High School in West Hartford, who's helped with this project. Grace, so nice to speak with you, too.
Nice to speak with you.
Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff, and our technical producer is Kyone Wolf. Also, thanks to WNPR intern Phil Geolopsis. And you can learn more about our show at WNPR.org/where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. And before we end, it's our fall fun drive, where we ask listeners to support the programming like Where We Live and all the other great shows on Connecticut Public Radio. Here are two of my colleagues to tell you how.